The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, I wanted to continue. Is this loud enough? Is this okay? Sound-wise? Okay. I wanted to continue a conversation about delusion. I started talking about delusion a couple of weeks ago. And I'll just recap a little bit. I'll just kind of give a little context before I go into the particular area around delusion I wanted to talk about today. You know, so much of our choices in life, so much of the way we act, so much of the way we engage with other people, so much of what happens in our lives is happening kind of, you know, what in our culture is often talked about in the subconscious or in the unconscious area. There's unconscious or subconscious motivations, opinions, ideas, views, agendas that are just not clear to us, and that's where a lot of our actions spring from. As I mentioned in the guided meditation, you know, the meditation practice begins to reveal some of those habits of mind. You know, you sit here and you recognize, you know, just how much you don't like things or just how much you're pulled towards things. So just some of the habits and patterns of our mind are revealed as we just start to very simply pay attention. And so one of the things that I think this meditation practice begins to do is to reveal the areas of the subconscious, of what we would call subconscious. It begins to reveal things that are habitually tend to be below what we can usually see, below what we can usually be aware of. And that's one of the great things about meditation practice. In fact, I think in my own exploration of the mind, my own mind, I'm beginning to think there's not really a barrier between what we would call the conscious and subconscious. It's just a matter of how much awareness there is, how much the mind, that the layers of what we call subconscious can become conscious. The subconscious area feeds on unawareness. And as we begin to bring awareness, we begin to see what would be subconscious or unconscious. So the delusion, we can talk about delusion as being the Buddhist language for subconscious or unconscious. You know, this is the way the Buddha has talked about it, that the motivations of our mind in the area of delusion are those motivations, those choices that we make that we are not aware of. And the levels of delusion in our minds it goes very deep. Now, there's the kind of basic level of delusion that is when we're just checked out, you know, when we're lost in thought, when we're caught in some story or some idea and aren't really aware of what's happening in the present moment, that's a form of delusion because we're not here. We're not knowing. We're not present for what's actually going on in the present moment. So that's a form of delusion. That's probably the simplest form of delusion when we're lost in our own thought bubbles, our own thought worlds. So that's one layer of delusion, and I talked about that last couple weeks ago. And then another layer of delusion comes from our own personal conditioning, the way that we were raised, the ideas, the views that we have about ourselves and others, what we're capable of, what we think about other people. You know, so-and-so is always X, or so-and-so never does X, or even... you know, different ways that we inhabit various roles with, you know, like, you know, we may have a role at work and then accidentally, you know, it's like, you know, so it's kind of, we kind of move into that role without being conscious of it. You know, we've got ways that the workplace conditions us to behave. You know, whether we're in an office or whether we're on a job site, you know, whatever, there's kind of, you know, hidden rules that we operate by in those areas. We get conditioned to behave in certain ways in our workplace. And then we might become aware of that conditioning when we go home and start, you know, if we don't remember we've gone home and start acting like we do on the job site at home, you know, this can happen sometimes. I think particularly with certain kinds of jobs, like being a teacher, you know, it's kind of like you can take your teacher home with you and, you know, start teaching your family. And that pretty quickly, you know, you get the feedback, you know, you're not the teacher here, thank you. So, you know, we can kind of operate subconsciously based on ways that we've been conditioned in our lives. So that's another layer of where delusion can enter. We can be aware of that conditioning and aware of how it is influencing us, or we can just be kind of blindly acting from those ideas, those agendas, and not really be so conscious of how those agendas, those views are impacting us. So, you know, a simple kind of example on this, trying to decide which one to use or what to bring up here. I'll pick an aversion example just for my own conditioning has tended towards the place where I tend to have aversive responses to things. And so when I'm in an aversive mode, or actually even when I'm not in an aversive mode, you know, one time I was kind of shocked when I was doing a guided meditation. A teacher was asking me to begin to explore broader experience in my experience other than just my breath. And he was doing it in a guided meditation. He said, just, you know, notice, you know, without choosing what it is that your attention lands on. He said, this is how we explore what we sometimes call choiceless awareness. So he used that term, you know, I think he used that term. In any case, I had that term in my mind when he said, just let your attention land anywhere. What is it that your attention lands on, you know, when it's not with the breath? And so it's like, okay, right now, where's my attention? You know, where's my attention drawn? And each time I looked at where my attention was drawn, it was an unpleasant experience. And after a few times of that, every single thing my attention was drawn to, every time I checked, okay, where's my attention now? It was some unpleasant experience. And I, after a few minutes of that, I turned to my teacher, I said, this cannot be choiceless, you know, because there's got to be some things that are not unpleasant happening here. This is kind of what we might call a filter that, you know, in my mind, I had so habituated the mind towards, you know, the aversive things, you know, even though I wasn't experiencing aversion in that moment, it's like my mind had a filter of find the unpleasant and, you know, take care of the unpleasant, and that is where happiness follows. And so that it was like having a lens on, a kind of a lens that said, the unpleasant things are the important things to pay attention to. And that's a form of delusion. It's not unawareness in that place. I mean, I was aware, I was knowing what was happening, but there was this filter operating in my mind that was picking out of the environment things that the idea or the agenda or habit of the mind felt like were the most important things to pay attention to. So that's a form of delusion. It's a subtler level of delusion than the kind of delusion that comes from just not being aware. That seeing, actually, it was quite a teaching. I mean, he was trying to help me to not stay stuck on the breath and begin to open my attention, but it was also a very important teaching on how my attention works. You know, how my attention was gravitating towards the unpleasant. When we see that, when we can begin to recognize how our minds do have these filters, You know, when we can begin to see that the mind does have those filters, we can begin to counter them or recognize when we're acting from that perspective. And possibly, you know, one way that I could explore that at that time was like, okay, let me see, is there something pleasant here? Well, the sensation of my lips touching together, that's definitely not unpleasant. I don't know if I'd call it pleasant, but, you know, it's not unpleasant. How about the sensation of the coolness on my cheek? Well, you know, that actually is kind of pleasant. You know, so the mind could begin to counter that habitual filter. So we have many, many kinds of personal filters that get built in through the way we live. Another one, I think I used this one in the last class. You know, when I was young, I was very short. I was, you know, a good foot shorter than everybody else in my first grade class. And I had bad eyes. And so the teachers always put me in the front row of the class. And to this day, when I go someplace, I am more comfortable sitting in the front row. You know, that's where I'm drawn to be. I have been habituated to being there through years of being in the front row in my early years of school. I even created stories about why I was in the front row, you know, as I became, you know, more of an adult. It's like, I'm sitting in the front row because I'm really interested. Maybe, but, you know, that's probably mostly because I was put there, and that's where I became comfortable. So there's so many different unconscious things that happen based on, you know, how we're treated by schoolmates, how our parents raise us, how we are, you know, treated by teachers, or it's just so many things. What we see on the television, you know, what we see here on the radio, we take all of this in, and it becomes, oh, this is the way the world is. And then we don't actually see that we're seeing the world through a perspective. You know, cultural differences, you get a taste of this when you go visit another culture, of just how different the conditioning is. You know, how close you stand to somebody, whether you make direct eye contact, whether you shake hands with them, you know, those kinds of things, you know, that we just kind of naturally do. When you go to another culture and somebody's not responding that way, it feels a little odd. And this is, you know, these kinds of things, these are habituated. Now, these kinds of things aren't, you know, they're not necessarily going to create suffering, but there are, you know, kind of interacting cultures in this culture where there can be suffering that comes around assumptions that are made about how people interact together. So these kinds of things are in the terrain of what we could call personal or societal delusion, views, opinions, agendas, ideas that come from how we personally were cultured, incultured. And that's a big terrain of suffering, actually, those views that we hold. I mean, you could hold a view about what you're capable of and suffer around the idea that you're not capable of something, when it's all that it is an idea in your mind. And so, you know, becoming aware that we have filters like this, we can begin to recognize, oh, maybe this is a filter. Maybe this is actually a belief, not a truth. That's a really helpful thing to begin to recognize. So exploring belief, exploring what do I believe in this situation if there's suffering happening. You know, if there's some kind of struggle happening, checking in, what are the beliefs around that? That is a good way to begin to reveal some of these subconscious patterns and habits, some of these views that we're not seeing. We even just ask ourselves, what belief is operating here? And then to recognize, I mean, you don't have to tell yourself it's not true. But you also don't have to take it as truth. Just recognize it. This is a belief. Some of these, kind of like, we may have a belief around, what's right in terms of how close you stand to somebody, when you're speaking. And if somebody does something different, it becomes like, well, this is wrong, as opposed to, oh, this is a belief. This is a belief of mine, that this is a belief perhaps of my culture, that there needs to be more distance here. So, okay, that's a belief. Just recognizing as belief. That's a really good inroad to begin to reveal some of these subconscious delusions that happen. And then there are some more insidious kinds of delusion, even than the ones that we're encultured to. There are some delusions that we all share as human beings, no matter what our culture. And these kinds of delusions tend to be more based in our biology, in our evolution, than they are in our culture. And so these are the deepest layer, the most hard to see, and the most tenacious kinds of delusion. So that's what I'd really like to explore today, that level of delusion. Shakespeare had a quote, let's see if I can find it here, it's from The Tempest. There's some really great quotes in The Tempest. He's such an astute observer of humanity. And in The Tempest, it's kind of a magical tale, but there are these people that have landed on this island, and they're like checking it out, and it's got some weird things happening on the island. And this guy is looking around, and he's describing what he's seeing. And two other guys are standing there going, okay, yep, he's describing what's here, but... And then one of them says, he misses not much. And the other one says, no, he doth but mistake the truth totally. So this is, this happens to us in our lives. We see things, but we mistake the truth. And this is this level of more human delusion. We operate in the world with assumptions about the world that are not in alignment with reality. It's kind of frightening when we start to recognize this and think about this, kind of like, it's really humbling. And we all have it's all very much based on evolution, survival. And so again, it's not that we need to reject how we operate. But what the Buddha says is that when we're operating with these filters, and I'll just name them right now so that you have a sense of what I'm talking about, we tend to take things that are impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take things that are unreliable as a place for lasting happiness as reliable places for lasting happiness. And we tend to take what is not self to be self. What is not me, not mine, not I, to be I, me, mine. So we act in the world with these assumptions. And with those assumptions, for instance, around impermanence, the assumption around permanence, when we assume things are permanent, we create particular views, opinions, ideas about things that are permanent, and it tends to create this place of, oh, if I have this thing, it means I'm going to have it forever. Or, like a relationship, even a car, even something as simple as a car, it's like, I have that car, it's my car, it's there, and it's going to be mine until I choose to say no, until I choose to get rid of it, and then I get rear-ended, and it's like the car becomes totaled. It's like, oh, well, okay, that car as a functioning entity is not permanent. So even simple things like that, you know, we function as though things were permanent. And because of that, we behave in certain ways around those things. And that behavior is informed by an incorrect view, an incorrect belief, and we suffer from that. So I've also been reading Proust lately. And he's got some great quotes. He's also a very astute observer of the mind. And here's something he had to say, the beginning of In Search of Lost Time. "Perhaps the immobility of things around us is imposed on them by our certainty that they are themselves and not anything else, by the immobility of our mind confronting them." That's very wise. Perhaps the immobility of things around us is imposed on them by our certainty that they are themselves and not anything else, by the immobility of our mind confronting them. So how this works, I mean, one of the reasons why this is such a strong delusion for us is because of the way our senses work. In fact, our minds, our brains are designed to put things together to create a kind of coherency around things. You know, when I look at that wall, you know, I see it's very, very difficult for me to look at that wall and not know very deeply in my body that that wall is hard. If I were, you know, it's like as soon as I see that wall, you know, the body knows from having walked into walls that it would be painful to run at full tilt and confront that wall. So, you know, there's various, you know, sense impressions that have come together to create, when we look at something, you know, various sense impressions that have come together to create our experience of that. What's happening in my visual field is that there is, you know, form and color. That's what's happening. And yet the mind has put it all together in terms of an object. And I'm not saying that there's not an object there. But what happens is that we begin to relate to things in the world not through the things themselves, but through our idea about them. This is where the delusion creeps in. It's not that, you know, I should run at that wall full tilt. You know, if I do that, I'll hurt myself, I'll get bruised on my face, and, you know, there'll be pain, right? So it's not that I'm saying we can, you know, it's the illusory nature of the impermanent nature of the world that creates the illusion of so many different things in the world. It's not that I'm trying to tell you not to believe that they exist, but they exist in a way, I mean, the way we relate to them isn't through the actual experience, but through our idea of them. And when we relate to things through our ideas, the delusion begins to creep in. It's kind of like those filters that operate, the filters around greed, the filters around aversion, they begin to operate with the concept. When we're actually in touch with the actual experience of what we're interacting with in the world, what we could call the objects in the world, when we're actually aware of the actual experience of that, it's much harder for those filters to be at play. It's much harder for those filters to be at play. And so the impermanent nature of, I'm going to back up for a second, because there's different levels of impermanence. I kind of dove into the deepest level there. You know, even something as simple as recognizing our human lives are impermanent is a very profound and deep wisdom that can inform our lives. One of the quotes in the Dhammapada is, you know, most people are not really aware that everyone will die. When people realize this, quarrels cease. If you really, really deeply knew that this moment might be your last moment on earth, how much pettiness would drop away? How much views and opinions about what should happen, what shouldn't happen, how much of that would drop away? So even taking in, I mean, we all know at a very intellectual level, we know at an intellectual level that we are going to die. But we do not live from that knowledge. There's a way that we are walking around assuming our own immortality. I mean, we know consciously it's not here, but that mortality, that's always somewhere out there. It's not actually here and now. That possibility is not actually here and now. And so that, even that level of recognizing impermanence is very powerful for us in terms of how it makes us, how it creates us engaging in the world. Then, you know, another thing, another way we can begin to understand how the illusion of permanence happens for us is by, you know, reflecting on I'm going to talk about how it used to be with films. You know, there used to be those individual frames. Everybody knows this, right? You know, there used to be the individual frames, and there was frame after frame after frame after frame. And the projector created the illusion of objects moving around because of the speed with which the frames moved past the light. That kind of thing happens our senses are designed kind of to put together little tiny bits of information and create the illusion of, create the sense of things out there. Now, this is extremely helpful. You know, this is very evolutionarily adaptive that we see, you know, that we see, we walk into a room and we see people, we see chairs, we see carpet, we see objects, you know, so we're not going to be running into things, you know, that the eyes have learned the eyes and the brain together have learned how to instantaneously identify objects. We don't have to, when we come into a room, figure out, right, that's a person, that's a chair, that's a wall, that's a floor. The mind does that for us. And the place, again, where where delusion can creep in is that we relate to things as concepts rather than what they actually are. And with concept, you know, when I relate to a person in particular from the perspective of a concept, that concept has an obscuring quality to it. It obscures, we come with that concept, we come with ideas, with views, beliefs about that person. And because the ideas, the views, beliefs are so close to a simple concept, they get conflated and we don't recognize that we're seeing somebody through that lens. Another area of way this can happen, so, you know, we create, this is something that we can see in meditation. If there's a painful experience in meditation, you know, if the body gets in some place or time where there's a like I've got in my hip right now a little bit of an ache. When we see that from the idea of pain, it becomes a block. You know, we're experiencing that as a thing, as an idea. That's pain. And idea of pain comes with a whole bunch of baggage. Idea of pain comes with, this is a problem, this is going to, you know, cause problems in the future. Oh my goodness, maybe I've got a tear in my hip cartilage and I'm not going to be able to take that hike that I'm supposed to take. Or, you know, so all kinds of ideas come along with this concept of pain. When we actually, and because of that, so there's the pain itself, there's unpleasant sensation. There's an unpleasant sensation in my hip right now. It's not terribly unpleasant at this point. But I have seen in my own experience that when I bring a attitude of pain, problem, a whole bunch of laying on top of it of concerns and confusions, that pain becomes much more unpleasant. You know, that the attitudes of mind actually make the experience, it multiplies the pain to have those ideas. And when we can actually relate to that pain through just, well, what is the experience? Oh, there's a mild unpleasant pulling. Okay. I can experience that. It's not particularly, I'm not concerned about it. You know, it's just a mild, unpleasant pulling experience. So when we can meet the experience, and plus which with seeing the pain from this less, you know, thing way, as if it's a solid thing, as if it's an entity, I can see that place of pulling, actually at this moment it disappeared. Oh, now it's back. Oh, there, it's gone. Oh, now it's back. So it kind of actually comes and goes. And I'm seeing actually that it's coming and going with the subtle movement of my spine. You know, that it seems to come and go. Now, I've also seen this in a deeper state of meditation, that when you can actually meet the experience as it is and see how rapidly things are changing. No, we react to the unpleasant. We push away the unpleasant. That feeds back in our mind that things are a problem, that things are difficult, and it creates the idea that it's there all the time makes that feedback loop very strong. But when we actually see that it disappears for moments, you know, I was quite surprised on one long retreat where I was working with something that was quite unpleasant. No, this is really mild. You know, I was working with something that was really unpleasant, but I was watching it kind of spark and burn and pulse, and there were split seconds in there in watching all of that there was no pain at all. And the mind got a relief in that moment. The mind could relax in that split second, and then the pain would come back. But because the mind was not clamping down around the bursts of pain, there was much more ease around the experience. So that's one. That's another example of a way we make things out of things. So in this, we also assume permanence of mind states. Sometimes, you know, this is a really this is real a delusion here. I mean, before I really started meditating, I had a story. I am a miserable person. And, you know, that was my perspective. You know, it's like that was so true in my experience that pretty much whenever I checked in, I was miserable. There were times I noticed I wasn't miserable, but that belief in the permanence of that the, you know, there was an identity around that. You know, the belief in that was so strong that even when I wasn't feeling miserable, It's like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but really what I am is miserable. You know, there wasn't any room for that happiness to take root. I would just kind of drag the miserable back in because of that sense of it being a thing, because of it being a... And so that is another area. If you have patterns and habits of mind that you think are always there, notice when they're not, because they are not always there. You know, sometimes we can have, you know, certain states like, you know, depression. For me, depression, there was, you know, it was a pretty potent state, and yet there were times when it wasn't there. You know, so let yourself recognize when the impermanence of mind states, especially ones you really strongly identify with, it begins to poke holes in the belief that it is a thing. I'm trying to decide how much time. Oh, let's see. I'll go on to seeing what's unreliable as reliable. This is a... This one is kind of related to the idea that things are permanent. You know, that because we believe that things are permanent, because we have this belief, and again, it's not that we believe, yes, this is going to last until the end of the universe, or even that the universe is lasting for... We know, right? We know that the universe is ebbs and flows. I mean, science tells us that the universe itself will end, that the sun will explode and it'll burn up the planet at some point. But that all, you know, that's all way out there, you know. So, you know, we really, for the way we operate moment to moment, we operate as though things are things, as though things are permanent. And because of that sense of permanence, sense of stability of the world, and partly because we've been trained by our own response to the world, we think that having things that this mind-body process thinks are pleasant is going to be happiness. You know, that if we have in our experience pleasant things, and then we think we can keep them. So, you know, a relationship, you know, it's like, okay, I've got this relationship. This relationship is mine, and I'm going to have this relationship. And, you know, even though we know that it's a dynamic, flowing thing, there's a way that we kind of make a thing out of it and attach our happiness to it. You know, or something like having somebody's good opinion of us. You know, we think that we can be happy, or we think that we need people's good opinions in order to be happy. We think we need to have things that are pleasant in order to be happy. And in this way, we are relying on our happiness for things that are not very reliable. How reliable are the opinions of other people? I mean, we know in our own mind how reliable our own minds are. You know, they change all the time. For us to say, my happiness depends that everybody around me sees me in a certain way, that's a really unreliable place to find happiness. For me to say that in order to be happy, I have to have this kind of a house, I have to have this kind of thing in my life, again, it's very unreliable. You know, people in Iraq right now, you know, it's like, what they had, including their own lives, you know, what they had is just being destroyed. Nebraska, there was these tornadoes, you know, If we're relying on things in the world being a certain way, in order to be happy, we will suffer. And so this is, again, this is an area of delusion. We through our lives, through our, you know, the way we've engaged in the world, you know, I have a piece of chocolate here, I pick it up, I eat it, it tastes good, it makes me feel good, you know, it's like that's happiness. There is some happiness with getting pleasant things. There is some happiness with that. The mistake is in believing that happiness is as good as it gets. And that's a part of the delusion, actually. There is a kind of happiness that comes from having people see us, from having people mirror us and appreciate us. There is a kind of happiness that comes from that. And yet to believe that that is the only way, or that has to happen in order to be happy, that's delusion. That's where this, you know, kind of operating, I mean, we've learned, I mean, babies begin to learn this immediately. I'm hungry, I get food, I feel good. I have, you know, warm things around me, that feels good. I have a toy I like, that's nice. You know, there's that kind of happiness that we learn from the very moment we are born, that getting what I want makes me feel good. Not getting what I want makes me feel unhappy. And so it's very deeply conditioned in us, this kind of belief that that is how happiness happens. One of the key things that we begin to see as we explore our minds in meditation is that, you know, that when we have something, if there's something there that we want, something pleasant that we want, you know, we project into the future. We think, if I get that thing, if I have that thing, I'll be happy. And so there's that kind of construct of the mind that's going, an idea that's formed in the mind, that's going to be happiness. And so we're at that point, we're not seeing actually that there's something else going on, that it feels like there's something wrong that I don't have it. You know, the feeling of wanting, the feeling of, I need that thing. I need that thing in order to be happy. I need that thing in order to feel good about myself. I need to convince you to think a certain thing about me in order to feel okay about me. So we have that movement and that wanting, the very wanting, the feeling of that need to have the thing or to have the opinion. That very wanting is a large part of the feeling of things are off right now. In fact, it is the feeling of off right now. Only often we don't even notice that because we're projecting into the future, even just 2 seconds into the future, of how it's going to be when I get that thing or have that person believe that thing. And so we have that. We miss, actually, that there's a feeling that something's off if I don't have what I want. And so there's that. That's a form of delusion as well, that we're not seeing what's actually here. So that we, you know, we miss that, you know, there's a subtle feeling. When you can explore this in meditation, you know, you can explore this feeling of, you know, one way to play with it is if there's just a little bit of discomfort in your body, or there's an itch. Itches are great in meditation, you know. They really can illuminate this. How much, there's the itch, which, you know, the itch itself has got an unpleasant quality to it. It's a zing, it's an on-off kind of very strong sensation. And then there's the wanting to get rid of the itch. And that wanting is actually the largest part of the problem. That, you know, we think that we have to do something in order to get rid of the itch. But really what we're trying to do is to get rid of the wanting. Because if that wanting isn't there, if there's just that sensation coming and going, and that wanting isn't there, the wanting to get rid of it isn't there, it's actually not a problem. It's just a sensation appearing. It's just a sensation appearing. And so this begins to illustrate for us that the delusion around the unreliability of things, you know, that we taking what's unreliable as reliable, has to do with this belief that I have to get what I want in order to be happy. And the Buddha actually suggests there's another way towards happiness, which is to actually see that the wanting itself is an impermanent state and that the wanting can go away. Now, this is a complex area. It's not that we don't, you know, fulfill our basic human needs to eat, to have a relationship, to have, you know, warmth and connection. But there's a way that we miss that so much of our dissatisfaction and so much of the way that we operate in the world is coming from this believing that getting what I want is the best way to happiness, is the only way to happiness. And so beginning to explore that piece, greed and aversion arise out of this fundamental delusion. So greed itself is that pull towards something pleasant, that, ooh, that would be nice. Aversion itself is the kind of resistance to something unpleasant. Delusion is operating in both of those by, around greed, the idea that I need to have that thing in order to be happy. I need to get rid of that thing in order to be happy. And the Buddha is actually pointing to us, we don't need anything in the world to be any different in order to be happy. It's possible to be happy just as one is in this moment. And then one steps forward from a place of sufficiency rather than a place of lack. We can act in the world out of this place, from this place of sufficiency, and choose to act out of compassion, out of kindness, out of wisdom, rather than out of greed and aversion, kind of acting subconsciously, these greed and aversion, acting subconsciously, making us, you know, it's like these little switches that are being flipped all the time when we're not aware of it. Ooh, need that. Ooh, need to get rid of that. Like that very first thing I mentioned with my teacher, you know, it's like I was just unaware that my mind oriented toward the unpleasant. Like that would be, I'd walk into a room, it's like, oh, I don't like that. Oh, I don't like that. Oh, I don't like that. It wouldn't see the spaciousness or the beauty. You know, so that when we don't see how our minds work, the delusion can enter. So I'm going to actually stop there and leave the third part of seeing what is not self as self to be a whole extra talk, another talk, the next time I'm back, which is a couple weeks from now again. So I want to open it up to comments, questions, because this is a complex area. And Bill, did you have something? Yeah, and then Laura.
Coincidentally, a few days ago, I was using practicing loving kindness meditation. I've been doing that more recently, at the suggestion of a book I read, of course. Not of course, but as a book. And as I was trying to sort of give more meaning than just the rote repetition of the words, I discovered that inside me was something, I don't know what it is yet, that said, that resisted the happiness, that said I wasn't supposed to have the enduring kind of, I mean, I'm allowed to have, you know, the occasional peak experience, so to speak. I can laugh at a joke and feel happy about it, or I can get the chocolate and be happy about it, but I'm not supposed to have enduring happiness.
Mm. So that's also delusion.
Oh, that yes.
Belief. Yeah.
That I recognize.
Yeah.
I don't recognize what else is there.
Yeah.
Yet.
And so this is great that you see that, right? I mean,
yes. Oh yes.
I mean, it's like when this kind of thing is so hidden from us. And to actually see it, I mean, sometimes we get depressed when we see things like this. It's like, oh, you know, it's like, I didn't know that was in my mind. But thank goodness we're now aware that it's there, because if we're not aware of it, it's driving how we're acting. And if we can be aware of it, there's the possibility to begin for the mindfulness to begin to massage it, you know, the mindfulness and wisdom to begin to massage it. And to look at some of the underlying beliefs there and holdings there. You know, the Buddha at one point said, luminous is this mind, but it is obscured. That luminousness is obscured by defilements that visit it. And so that belief that I'm not worthy, you know, that kind of not worthy belief or something along those lines, or, you know, the resisting of that kind of happiness, I'm not supposed to have that. I don't remember exactly the words you used.
I said that there was something resisting it, that I was not supposed
not
to have
supposed
it.
Not supposed to have it.
I'm sure there's a lot more in there that I haven't discovered yet.
Yeah, and so, you know, it can be painful to see that. And yet that very pain is, and sometimes some teachers talk about the metta practice in particular as being kind of like, it's like a metta magnet, you know. It's like pulling we're running a metta magnet over our heart, and it's pulling what's not metta out, you know. And that process can feel painful, but it's becoming conscious, and so great. And Laura wanted to say something, and then we need to stop.
Yeah. So I had a very recent experience of starting to have some disillusion in the wholesome sense with seeing kind of attainment of things as producing satisfaction. And literally, I spent time in a high-end kitchen store because I had to replace something of someone's that I had broken. And it's a place that I always just used to completely trip out on. And I did, you know, I bought the one thing that I needed to buy, didn't buy anything else, but I spent a lot of time looking and ogling. And I had a really distinct sense, you know, partly because I've heard this described by others as an insight, but I really saw that in the leaning toward each of these things that I didn't need and that were made to look good, you know, and were not needed by anyone, that there was some suffering, that there was some friction. And so it was a sense of, okay, I'm actually seeing this. And at the same time, there was a little sense of loss, like of not wanting to quite have that recognition that this really isn't where the goods are. But it's like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, when we begin to see, oh, actual happiness doesn't, you know, that you know, gosh, if I get that thing, and then we begin to see having that thing, well, you know, it's going to sit in a drawer. It's going to make me feel good in this moment to buy it, and maybe for a few weeks, but, you know, it's not really ultimately going to produce that happiness. But there is a feeling, there can be a feeling of, oh, you know, it's that breaking of that illusion, you know, that disillusionment, without quite seeing the joy of the release. So yeah, I mean you know, when we start, you know, keep looking, you know, you saw the wanting, you saw the unpleasantness of that, and you know, one of the things you could explore in that kind of a situation is to watch and see, when does that wanting end? You know, did it end when you walked out of the store? You know, you walk out of the store, it's like, phew, thank goodness I'm not exposed to looking at all those things that are tempting me. You know, it's like, what is that like? What is that release from that wanting like? When you feel the release from the wanting, you get a taste of a deeper kind of ease. You know, it's like, it's not having things that has that deeper kind of happiness. It's actually letting go. And in that letting go, paradoxically, much more states of happiness appear. It's the kind of that's the paradox of this. It's really not about accumulating. And it's so counter to the way that we have engaged that it's hard to believe. And so there is that sense of loss. There is that sense of loss until we actually begin to feel the joy of the letting go. Yeah. So thank you all. And more about the illusion of self in a couple of weeks.